So just again, another quick recap of last Sunday, what we've been kind of building up to is what I described as we moved into the realm of what I would call actual spiritual practice or religious practice, which is maybe a little bit what strongly stated, but it seems like when we go into the receiving of the precepts, as I talked about last time, there's the teaching that Reverend Master Jiyu offered on that is taking us finally to kind of the core of her teaching, which is very, very much about, you know, we talked about the Lord of the House, the still small voice. She would talk about the eternal, the unborn, the undying, the unchanging, the uncreated. We spent time with looking at, in the Shishogi, Dogen's description of karma, being aware of the fact that karma really exists, and that there is what we would call bad karma or evil karma, and that because of recognizing that behavior, those tendencies we have, there's this very deep, heartfelt sense that we need to receive the precepts. And receiving the precepts goes all the way from understanding the precepts from a change of heart to from what bad karma, behaving in negative ways, producing negative karma, to taking on the precepts and viewing them as a way of behaving properly, behaving well, creating merit, as Dogen talks about it. But then I pointed to the fact that receiving the precepts actually is pointing to, as Reverend Master Jiyu described it, heeding the still small voice, understanding, hearing the Lord of the House. And I talked quite a bit about the second of the three pure precepts, about do only good. And I wanted to, as I mentioned in the email, I wanted to talk about that a little bit more, because I think there's need for clarification. There's need for us to look at it more carefully, because it can be, it has been misunderstood quite a bit in the past. So I think it's really important to sort of listen to the language at face value initially. And I tried to put myself back into my frame of mind, say, when I was first starting this practice. I remember when I would go on retreat to Shasta Abbey for the lay people, right after morning service, as probably many of you remember, we would stay in the ceremony hall and have a spiritual reading period. And it was always recommended that we read the Kyoju Kaimon, read the precepts. So I'm remembering, you know, as a late 20-year-old, reading these precepts, and we come across, I wanted to pick out a few lines from the commentary on Do Only Good. For example, we have Reverend Master Jiyu saying, ask the Lord of the House at all times before you do anything whatsoever. Is it good? Is it your will? And then she says a bit further on, always you must ask the Lord of the House, always you must be humble in his presence. When the Lord speaks, spring up joyfully to answer. Then indeed it is good to do anything whatsoever he asks. And I think what's very interesting about this, and what we need to take care with, is how we should understand what's being said there. She's using personal pronouns. I think most of us at this point have made our peace with the fact that Reverend Master Jiyu, being of the generation she was, you know, using, if I'm using the right terms here, using male pronouns like, you know, him and his, and so on. I think we've made our peace with that, realizing that was just the way people would say it back then. But then we need to look at the fact that she's using a personal pronoun at all. You know, she just as equally could have said she or her. And the real significant misunderstanding that can come from all of this is that it's really personifying the Lord of the house, the still small voice. We could be excused for thinking that we're talking about something that plays very much into our culture, our country's history of, you know, of non-Buddhist religions, where we have this thinking of there being sort of, I guess I'll use the word, some sort of supreme being. So in many respects, we could read the commentary and think that it was referring to some sort of supreme entity or supreme being, something of that sort, which then we take to think, okay, this supreme entity is concerned with every aspect of my life. And not only is it concerned about every aspect of my life, but it actually knows exactly where my life should be going and what I should be doing. I would say that that's, you know, if you're coming from this stage of realizing that you have these bad karmic habits and that you need to improve on these karmic habits, you're still dealing with a very significant self. And a significant self, like in my case, is going to think, oh, there's this greater being that's concerned about myself. And that if I can just tune into this greater entity, then he or it will give me the scoop as to what I should do at every step of the way. I mean, I hope in a way this sounds a little bit silly, but historically, there have been a number of cases, number of situations that I've known about where, and I know mostly about monks, we're speaking many decades ago here, where there was this thought about, well, what, you know, you would pause and you would ask the Lord of the house, what should I have for breakfast? And what happens is that if you run in that direction, there might be psychological terms for that. I know that there are certain spiritual situations that can develop because of that, where, you know, a number of these monks had, Rinpoche Master Gyu had to kind of talk with them and kind of get them back on track. So I wanted to just bring that up in case some of the stuff I was reading last time, if in any way some of that was coming up for you. You know, I think Reverend Master Gyu has been criticized in other circles for coming across as being very sort of theistic in a lot of her language that she used in you know, her Buddhist teaching. But she was very much responding to the times and the fact that oftentimes the way Buddhism and Zen was understood in other circles was they were, as it were, kind of missing this other part. I remember once hearing, you know, Reverend Master Gyu would say that oftentimes in the early days, people would come to her knowing that she was basically the abbot of Shasta Abbey, was highly regarded as a teacher, a very senior monk and so on. They would come to her and ask if she could help them. And she said, I have one question for you. And that question was, do you believe that there is something greater than yourself? And she said that if they answered in the affirmative, that yes, they felt that there was something greater than their self, themselves, then she's like, right, okay, I can help you. I can teach you. But if there was a sense that no, you know, the self is the sort of the end of the line, she didn't actually say what she did if people answered that, you know, no, they didn't feel that way, that there was something greater than themselves. I'm sure they just kind of carried on at that point. I guess another thing to mention is that this commentary, the Three Pure Precepts commentary we have, came to Reverend Master Gyu way back in 1976 when she was on a very extensive retreat. And the retreat was initiated or prompted by her basically being told by a doctor that her heart was in such bad shape that she had a month to live. So the The retreat she was on was she was on death's door, and she was actually dealing with things a little more important than what she should eat for breakfast. She was looking at all of the things that she had gotten up to in her life, all of the things she had inherited from the past, and how best to move forward with all of that. So, you know, when it says, when Reverend Master Tu says, always you must ask the Lord of the house, yes and no. You probably don't have to ask, you know, what you need to prepare food-wise for your meal. So I think the way I wanted to move into describing this a bit more was that when Dogen uses the phrase receiving the precepts, I feel like he's talking about a spectrum of understanding there. And the deepest side of it is being touched on and being commented about in The Lord of the House and The Still Small Voice. But I think we can actually gain an understanding of it if we look at the other end of that spectrum, namely the actual keeping of the precepts. So one way of understanding of keeping the precepts is that in practicing the precepts, you are creating good karma, you're creating merit, as Dogen puts it. In other words, you're actually using your will, your volition to do good things, and you are the recipient of you're receiving the effects or the feelings of that. But if you look at the commentary of the precepts, and what the precepts are really pointing to is it's not about good karma. It's not about bad karma. It's not about choosing what to do and receiving the consequences of it. And we don't have to go too much more deeply in the commentary and the precepts to realize that following the precepts, what you are doing is you're stepping out of the practice of being self-centered. Everything I was already describing prior to that point is very much a self-centered perspective of this is bad karma, I don't like it. This is good karma, I prefer this. And the commentary on a number of the precepts are really, really point to that. And although the activities that we do in following the precepts, the doing, the results of following the precepts, although those are significant and important, and we want to be aware of them, more importantly, what it's doing, it's cultivating an attitude of mind. It's cultivating a perspective that is, I guess you could say initially, it's holding the thought, the sense that there may be something more than just this self-perspective here. You know, and initially it'll start out as what's more than a self perspective is that there are other selves around here, and it's important to take them into consideration. That's a good start in moving in that direction. So I guess one other thing to bring up is that, again, we're starting to become aware of being open to something more than just a self perspective. We're also very, very aware of what it's like when we are grasping onto or clinging to a self perspective. It's, you know, we can all describe it differently, but to me, a self perspective in any given situation has the sense of, I've always enjoyed using this phrase for the last number of years called circling the wagons. And when we're clinging to a self perspective, it's like we've circled the wagons. We've drawn in, we've created this structure, and this is just the way it is. This is the perspective we have. And circling the wagons obviously implies that there's a defensiveness going on, a protectiveness going on, a fortification. And then, you know, it kind of leads to, okay, you know, we need to kind of get ready for battle here. I forget how many talks ago it was when I first brought up the Shoshogi, but I had asked, so what does the role of, what role does meditation play in the Shoshogi, in terms of Dogen's description, discussion of all of this. And I think that this is starting to point to it, because as we have come to see in the practice of meditation, we become very aware of when there's grasping, when there's clinging, when we've circled the wagons, as it were, and we start softening that grip that we have. We start softening our reactions to things as they come up in meditation. So instead of denying something, repressing something, we're actually able to allow that which we're suppressing or repressing, denying, to actually be there, to start actually experiencing a little bit of its feelings that are there. So there's a softening to things and an opening to things. And contrary to circling the wagons and creating this very kind of enclosed space, we're actually opening things up again. I sometimes see it as, okay, this is the reaction myself is having, but in meditation, it's more realizing that that's only part of the picture. There's the self with its reaction, but there's also all of this other stuff going on. So to me, this is what Reverend Master Jiu is referring to by when she says, always ask the Lord of the house. And what she's saying is through the practice of meditation, we're learning how to always bring into the situation a gentleness, a softness, and an openness. You know, mind you, it can take many, many years in a given area for that to start emerging. But the still small voice is something, interestingly enough, that we, as it were, sense or hear, however you want to describe it, only when we've stopped circling the wagons, only when we've stopped clinging to how things need to be or how things are. And to me, the still small voice or the Lord of the house could equally be described as when we're willing to open up again, it's the situation that we're in itself that is what we sense, is what we hear, is what informs us. I seem to remember going back a long, long time, but I would always have this phrase about, I give myself to meditation. You know, I sit my body and mind down, and I give myself to meditation, which I see as I'm giving myself to what's actually present there. And part of it is, you know, the things I'm holding on to, the things I'm pushing away, the reactions that come up in a given situation. But in giving myself to it, I'm giving myself to the reality of life that's going on in any given moment, in any given event, in any given situation I find myself. And that it's the situation itself within the whole context that's, as it were, speaking to me, or that I'm sensing. And from that, over time, we just have a way of, as Reverend Master Jiu put it, knowing what is good to do. It's not that I know what's good to do, it's that the situation within, you know, the complexity and the variability of what's going on, it knows what to do, as it were. And the knowing isn't really, there isn't a something that knows. It's more that's the way we kind of verbalize it. And I once did a Dharma talk at Throssell, where I started off by saying, you know, how does water know how to flow downhill? And it was partly to tease out the fact that, well, water flows downhill. In that situation, that is what it does. There isn't a, as it were, a knowing entity, but there is also a movement that happens that's quite natural or quite direct when it occurs. And in many respects, the commentary in, you know, do only good is touching on that aspect again. When I thought, the example that got brought up last Sunday, which Maria brought up an example, which I think struck me as being a really classic one, where this may be me paraphrasing it, so you can correct me if I miss any important details, but she was in a situation where many of the dogs, and this one particular dog, was behaving in such a way that a huge amount of kind of fear was arising. It was very much triggering a self-reaction there. But then in giving herself to the situation, being present with the situation, which is another way of saying meditating with the situation, there was recognizing, seeing how the self was reacting, but then what arose also was this sense of, if I'm remembering correctly, of going into the pen where this rather fierce dog was. And that wasn't an idea that was coming to yourself. It was an idea or a sense that was coming up within the situation. And in fact, oftentimes the self would think, oh, this is crazy, or this is not going to work, or the self feels completely lost. But then in stepping, I guess one of the ways I see it too is that we have a body and a mind. We have skills, we have capabilities, we have, in the traditional sense, we have areas of knowledge that we have. And when we're in a given situation, when we find ourselves in a given situation and are being still with, are meditating with, are giving ourselves to the situation we're in, things will, as it were, arise, be presented to our body and mind that we can offer, you know, we can, as it were, lend a helping hand to the situation we're in. You can put each and every one of us, you know, here in this meeting in the same situation, and slightly different things will come to mind for us as to what seems good to do or how we can help. So a lot of the time in talking about this area, one's almost forced in a way to have to talk about kind of the results, the things that happen. But I think much more significantly or more importantly, is over time, there seems to be a shift, at least in perspective, if not what awareness or consciousness, from we all have this tendency, you know, at some points in our life to feel very much just, again, sort of centered in being a self, centered in being a body and a mind. And yet over and over again, with giving ourselves to each situation as it arises, we start realizing there's a much deeper perspective, a much deeper awareness. There's a much deeper consciousness there, which includes me, but it's not limited by me. And over time, one feels that one's living more from that perspective than the perspective of always being kind of this more contained body and mind. Having that perspective, having that consciousness, having that awareness, it will still come to us. The word's a little awkward here. It will still come, you know, to this body and mind in terms of what I can do, how I can lend a hand, what I can do to be of help. It's just that the perspective or the place of knowing, as it were, has moved on. It's more embedded in something that is not specifically just tied to the self. So I think that kind of covers what I was wanting to talk about this morning. I think that broadens out a little bit more fully what I feel Dogen is pointing to, whatever Master Ji is pointing to, when we use the phrase receiving the precept. And this is more a preview of next Sunday, but it follows along so beautifully that the next section we have after receiving the precepts is awakening to the mind of the Bodhisattva. And it starts out by saying, when one awakens to true wisdom, it means that one is willing to save all living things before one is actually saved oneself. when our perspective, when our consciousness, when our awareness is actually more occupying that greater place, then all living things, which includes oneself, is the realm of our activity. Because all living things, which includes ourselves, that's actually more correctly or more fundamentally who we are, as opposed to being this separate, seeming, isolated self. And I think that brings to mind again, I think Reverend Master Ji would say this herself, I know it's something I've certainly emphasized, is that, you know, we have the three signs of existence, which are, you know, in each of the law of change, we have karma, and then we also have anatta, which often gets translated as no self. But I've always used that term anatta to mean no separate self. There's always going to be a body and mind until there isn't, until after we've done your funeral or my funeral, but it's not separate. It's not separate from all living beings, not separate from all living things. And what I've been touching on, you know, the vehicle of meditation, the practice of meditation allows us to start opening up to, and well, just what came to mind was hearing the cries of the world, you know, hearing the needs of the universe of which we are a part of. Okay, I will leave it at that for now.